Good morning, everybody. My name is Ed Mutum, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
By the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and sponsorship, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a mood-altering chemical since January 5th, 1971, and for that I'm extremely grateful. Man, I've had a great time. I want to thank Charlie and just everybody here. I want to thank the people out there serving those Cokes and working and people that did all the behind-the-scenes stuff that makes this happen. You know, we get to come here and we get to enjoy it, but that there's been a lot of work and there's been a lot of planning, and you've done a fine job this year, and I was pleased to find out you're in there. I was pleased to find out I was 7th or 8th down the list of speakers, but seems God will be done. But I, no, I'm just kidding. I really love being here. And it's just an honor and a privilege to do anything, whether you're up here speaking or I feel whether I get to mop a floor, you know. It's just absolutely amazing to be sober. And I want to thank everybody who worked here, and I want to thank your families for giving you up so you could do that, you know. Sometimes we forget those people at home that love us and would like to see us from time to time, too. And I want to thank them for being so kind and so giving of our time, too. And Jack, I love Jack. I love Jack and his lovely wife. You know, it's so nice to be around good people. I don't know about you, but my life didn't seem to start out that way. You know, I come from a very elite group of people called white trash, and wasn't easy holding up our image, but we managed. You know? You know, I laugh and joke about that now, but I also got to tell you, that was the toughest thing for me to shake getting sober. That feeling that I was absolutely worthless, that there was something inside of me that was just bad, and I couldn't seem to shake it. And if you've ever had those kind of feelings about anything in your past, I'm here to tell you it's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that eventually you will no longer have to feel that way. And I get up here in this area from time to time. I think the last time I was in Hagerstown was 1978. And I was with a basketball team at that time. You know, I was really touched. Larry talked, was a coach. And then, you know, we had Dave, and he was coach. And I've always been a large athletic supporter. And so it was really moving to me. And, I was the youngest of 7 children. I was the baby. You can imagine how big my brothers and sisters are. I was born 11 pounds and 1 ounce, 27 inches long, and my mother didn't like me at all. My mother and father were in their mid to late 40s when I was born, and I was an unplanned baby, as you say. Of course, they didn't plan them there. It was a Back then, it was just do what you could. And I don't know that that had any effect on my life. I'd sure like to think so. That way I could go to therapy. But I don't really think it did. I know that I probably was better taken care of than any of my brothers and sisters because I was the youngest. And when you're the youngest of 7 and 6 are gone, there's more stuff for you, you know. And, you know, I used to spend a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous telling you how bad my parents were. My dad drank. My mom was one of them goody-two-shoes Christian type people. And, you know, I just don't tell you that anymore because I realized that worse than their abuse was my abuse of them. It's Father's Day today. And I can remember the day I got kicked out of school at 8th grade, and they told me never to come back to any public schools in Iowa or Illinois. And Dad did the only thing he knew to do. He threw me up against the wall and started hitting me with his fist. And a few minutes later, he stopped and I said, "Are you finished?" And I left the house. I was a parent abuser long before they ever did anything bad to me. You see, nothing they did was ever quite good enough. I always wanted more, even with them. And I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I had to start looking for their goodness, rather than reasons to whine about them in meetings. And I'm so grateful for that. I don't know about you, but when I was a baby, I got a gift. I thought it was a gift. I could walk into a room of 300 people, 299 could turn around and say, Ed, you're the best. We love you. You're terrific. And one could go, jerk. Guess who got my full attention? What do you mean, jerk? You don't know me. I don't, you know. Week later, I'd sit up in bed and say, why would they say that? What's the deal? You know, and eventually what happened in my life was the 299s never existed anymore. It was just the ones. And when you're raised in an environment like I'm raised, where food's hard to come by from time to time for different situations and things like that, you get to pick up a lot of ones right away. And if you start putting those ones in your bag of life, you know what happens, at least if you're like me? It gets real heavy real quick. And you think, what's the use? My sponsor always says the worst thing he can ever hear any alcoholic say is, what's the use? I said that from a very early age. I don't know when I started drinking, because Dad used to think it was funny to get me drunk. And so I was always under the influence as long as I can remember, as long as I could walk to a refrigerator, get him a beer, and me get a big sip. And the more he drank, the bigger sips I got, and pretty soon it was two beers, you know. And so I don't know anything really about growing up as a normal child. I don't know any of that because very early on I started masking everything, not even knowing it. I knew a couple things, at least I thought I knew a couple things, that I didn't care. So much easier not to care. Isn't that great to pretend that? I don't care. Eventually, when I started getting in trouble and started doing things, look what you're doing to your mother. I don't care. Got married at 17. It was a nice wedding, matching shotguns. Very nice. Very soon after that marriage, it was, look what you're doing to that wife, and look what you're doing to that baby. I went, I don't care. And I told that lie so long, I actually got to believe in it. I don't know about you, but I lied so much, I'd lie when the truth had served me better. And I did that for a long, long time, and it didn't stop the minute I stopped alcohol in my system. It just didn't stop. I had to work these steps in order to do that. And I'm real grateful I did. I remember Mom dragging us to church. That's always fun. Going to church Sunday morning with seven little kids. And oh, boy, I hated church. Ministers, all ministers have thin blue lips, talk like this. They'd say things like, you're going to burn in hell, young man. That's what you're going to do. You're going to burn in hell. I'd think, how do you know? You only know me 20 minutes. In retrospect, by that time, they probably had it figured out, you know. But I hated church. I just hated church. And I collected ones at church. All the times I collected one. I remember there in the front row, there was this one guy every week. Sit there, pursed lips, and looked so holy. And I'd walk by him, and I think, you know, he looked like he was having a lot more fun in the bar last night, to be quite honest with you. I don't know who that grumpy girl is sitting with him, but the gal he was with last night seemed to be a lot more fun, too, you know. So I don't know about you, but I've decided right away that church was full of hypocrites. Hypocrites. Now, I know you're not this sick, but I was. I didn't only judge that guy and that entire pew and that entire church. Eventually, I judged entire organized religion by my little narrow pinpointed view and said they're all bad, they're all jerks. By one guy sitting in a pew, because I had my one. I had my one. And if I had my one, that was the truth. I don't care what you say. That's the truth. And the truth was killing me. I was a cop fighter. Any other cop fighters in the room? Yeah. There you go. Yeah, we got a gal back there. Good, good. Yeah, I got a guy. Yeah, good, good. Yeah. Love those girl cop fighters. You dating anybody? Yeah. We could kill each other in a couple butts. I remember that they, when I was 13 years old, I was arrested by the Iowa Highway Patrol for possession of a sawed-off shotgun. I had a double-barrel 12-gauge, about 14 inches long. And when I'd whip that bad boy out, I seemed to be in charge. And I liked that feeling. And they arrested me, oddly enough, for having that. And they took me to jail, and I remember the cops, would anybody object if I took off my coat? It's a little hot in here. Thank you. Pants are coming next. No, I lost my place. I got to start all over. My name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. But when I got arrested for the possession of that shot-off shotgun, they took me into the police station. They were going to teach me a lesson because I had a brother who was a two-time loser at that time. They were going to teach me how it was to be in jail, so they threw me in the hole. Left me there for 24 hours, and they taught me something. Cops are punks. And any time I see one, I'm going to swing. Now, if you're a cop fighter, and, you know, I didn't care if I saw a badge. I don't care if you were a crossing guard. I'd take you out, you know, just nothing personal, you know. Now, if you tended to do things like that that I did, I got news for you, especially if you're new or even if you're used. And you need to take this information with you. There's always more of them. Always more of them. And they get bigger as they come, you know? January 5th of 1971, I got sober. I went to my first AA meeting when I was 10 years old. I got a brother in South Carolina, Newberry, South Carolina, sober a little over 44 years. He took me to my first meeting when I was 10 years old, and he said, "You're going to be here one day, kid." And I went, "Bad chance." Oh, I remember some old guy up here about 20, 25. You know.
My name's Fred, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a good for you, Fred.
Said, "If I ever get old and burn out, I'll be here too." I didn't know I was a prophet at that point. It took a while. But... you know, I keep hearing things in AA too. They say, "Nobody's ever lied to me in AA." Well, they lied to me. They do, and I hear the lie often. At least it's a lie to me. They said to me, "You know, you keep drinking and using, you're going to die." And you know what I thought? Excellent. When? When will the madness end? You promise me it will? I'll go full tilt till it does. And I wouldn't die. Wouldn't die. Got angry at AA a lot because I wouldn't die. Even when I tried my hardest, couldn't die. Even when I challenged whoever it was and they were outnumbered me ungodly, I'd wake up and I'd be angry. I'd be mad. And I was always hoping a cop would take me out because, man, then I'd really be something. You know. January 5th of 1971, I was laying in the middle of the street in Davenport, Iowa at 6 and LeClaire. I was 20 years old. I was laying there, it was 18 below zero, and I was laying in the middle of the street right after I was in a car accident, pretending like I was knocked out. I'm not sure why, but it seemed like the thing to do at the time. And I remember the cops coming up, and they're saying, "That's Mutum, don't touch him, he's the scum of the earth. Car's probably hot, don't even cover the little SOB." Well, they didn't say little. Don't even cover the SOB. And the amazing thing happened, I agreed. I'm done. All of a sudden, it wasn't how I was raised, what I did or did not have, what opportunities I did or did not have, whether I was molested or not. And by the way, I was one of those that was molested by the neighborhood woman, and she was 28 and gorgeous, and I still look for her. Different strokes for different folks, I guess. I don't know. I wouldn't go to therapy for that because they'd enjoy it too much. And I know that's a bad thing, and I know all that, but it just never affected me badly. In fact, it was the only time I ever felt anybody cared for me before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was laying in the middle of that street, and they said all those things, and I couldn't argue anymore. The fight was over. And they rolled me up to the hospital and run me by some nurse who was standing there, and I happened to be there a lot, it seemed. And they rolled me by and said, "Ed, do you want me to call AA?" And I went, "Might as well." Now, us old-timers want to know why you can't be sincere like we were in the old days, you know. You know, if motives counted, these seats would be empty, I'm pretty sure. I've been around just 35 years compared to a lot of people this weekend. That's just a snap. But I have never in those 35 years saw anybody walk through that door and say, "I'm home." You know, do you know anybody that opened the French doors and said,
think I'll join AA today. God.
Sure wasn't the way I got here. I used to love wine. I was a wine connoisseur. I'd only drink certain types, you know, the Thunderbird and the Ariba. Ariba was good. It was 73 cents a quart. It was nice. Mad Dog 2020, those were good. And my drinking history had a lot of that other stuff. I do believe in singleness of purpose, by the way. But I also need to tell you that there was nothing I didn't get involved with that was around at the time. One thing you never heard me say is, what'll this do to you? What you heard me say is, got any more? And so that's why I introduced myself. When I introduced myself, is no mood-altering chemicals, because personally to me, that's sobriety. I don't have any mysteries. I'm not waiting for the scientific breakthrough. I've already found a spiritual breakthrough that answers my situations. And I'm real grateful for that. But, you know, when you drink all that wine, if you drink a lot of it, you get a little gift in the morning. And it was talked about just a tad the other day. I'm trying to think who it was. Maybe it was Larry talked about it. And it was the dry heaves. Oh, weren't those? And that slobber just get. And you know you're just about done when you taste your toenails. It was one of those mornings, and they took me into the. I was making my way back to the bed. And a guy came in named Hap, short for Happy, from Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "Hi, Ed, my name's Hap. I'm from A&A. And I thought, get out of my room, Jesus. But I didn't say that. I didn't say that. And he said to me, "We don't drink and we don't use one day at a time." And I said, you know what? I can't make it a whole day without something. Wish I could, but I haven't been able to in years. I just don't know that I can do that. And he said, "Ed, all you have to do is try." And that's the only thing I've done consistently from that day to this, is try, sometimes greatly, sometimes barely, to be a better person than I was the day before, and not drinking one day at a time. You know, I heard somebody say the other day, they were putting down, "And you don't drink no matter what." Whoa, that's stupid to say. Well, it says in the big book, it says, well, go to any length not to drink and to stay sober. It's the same thing. And he talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and by God's grace, I listened. And I instinctively knew to get busy right away. I got busy. I mean, I knew that I couldn't take time to think. If I took time to think, I was really in trouble. And when I got sober in 71, there wasn't a lot of treatment programs around in that, so you just kind of got sober on the natch. I'm going to get tangled up and trip here in a minute. And I was a shaker. And I don't mean the faith. I was a shaker. Jesus. How you doing, Ed? All good. How you doing, man? Nice to you. Cup of coffee, no thanks. Chip, cups chip my teeth. You know. And my arms just kind of. Piece of cake, no, can't have sharp objects. You know what it is. And it'd just be bad. And I had two rules. They were real simple rules. Don't come up behind me and don't touch me. Anybody can understand those rules. And I was sitting in that meeting in Central Discussion in Davenport, Iowa, and a little guy named Harry Stevens passed away. He was as tall as he was big around. Great guy. Harry was the coffee pourer in our group. And he'd come up behind me and he'd put his hand right here and he'd pour coffee. And the most amazing thing happened that I've ever known. There was a peace and a calmness that came over me that I never knew before. The madness had stopped. The guts had stopped churning. I could breathe. And he'd pour that coffee. And I swore he poured it slow. And then he'd get filled up and he'd go. And as soon as he'd take his hand away, the madness would start again. And I'd drink that coffee just as quick as I could. So Harry'd come back around. Big old tough guy like me. Little bitty guy like Harry. Calm the beast by the touch of the master's hand. Calm the beast. He had me. He had me there. You know, a lot of times we say it doesn't matter what you say to new people. I beg to differ. I mean, if you're a sponsor, one thing, but I could have been run out of here very easily. Could have been run out of here very easily, and I'm glad people were kind to me. I was 2.5 years sober living out in California, and I was stark raving sober. I was suicidal, depressed, and I mean, I was ready just to check out. And when you get that manic depressive type state, at least if you're like me, you're not interested in writing notes. You're interested in ending it. Now, I need to tell you, I haven't had a depression episode like that for a number of years, and I've had no other therapy than Alcoholics Anonymous and the grace of God, and I know that upsets people, but pray for me, you know. Never thought I'd be defending that in an AA meeting, but I was in that difficult, tough time. And my plan was to go to my sponsor's house, and in his garage, he had 3 big coffee pots operated with gas coffee pots, you know. And I was just going to go in the garage, turn on all the coffee pots, not light them, just lay down, go to sleep. No notes, no dramatics, I was just done. I was 2.5 years sober, and I got to the point of saying, you know, the magic is here for you, but I have no music in my heart. And I'm just sad, and I'm alone. And I stopped by a club at 26th and Broadway, or Cloverfield, excuse me, in Santa Monica, California, and I walked in there, and I had a friend, Jimmy R., Jimmy Ryan, Jimmy Passwell. Jimmy was from Texas. He was a rapid-fire talker. He'd talk like this, and he'd always rub his hands together like this. He'd just rapid-fire. He'd give you 3 talks time one. You know what I mean? He was just rapid-fire. He said, one time I asked some psychologist why I rubbed my hands together like this. He told me, I smacked him right in the mouth, you know. But that was Jimmy. And I walked in, and I don't know if Jimmy said it to everybody or not, but it really doesn't matter. He said it to me more than once. I walked in that day, and I already told you my plan. I'm going to get a cup of coffee, and then I'm just going to go turn on the gas. And I walked by Jim. And I say, Jimmy, how are you? And he stopped as if the world stopped, and I was the only person there, and he looked me right in the eye. And he said, I'm much better for seeing you today, my friend. I'm much better for seeing you. He saved my life that morning. Because I thought, if Jimmy likes me, maybe I got it all wrong. I'll go ahead and kill myself tomorrow. I'll put it off till then. Because it is a day at a time. And I've never forgotten that. I'm much better for seeing you, my friend. How much of our time do we spend lifting people up versus tearing people down? I don't know about you, but I spent a lot of time sober tearing people down. They'd have wonderful reputations, and I could point out the chip in their armor and ruin your image and bring it down to my level. And I try not to do that anymore. Try not to do that anymore. As I said, I started going to meetings, and I remember Logan, we buried with 56 years of sobriety. After 6 months, I got the keys to the club, having my feet up on the table. Logan walked into the club and said, you think you got all the answers, don't you, kid? And I said, no, but I was thinking, yeah, pretty much got this wrapped up. And he said, let me tell you something. I said, what's that? And he said, I was young once, but you've never been old. I was young once, but you've never been old. That's why I have nothing but respect for the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for chopping those weeds so I could see a path. And forgive me if I've ever criticized you, because I've never really meant to, especially when I know your value. And it always kind of annoys me when I hear somebody say, well, he's got that. See, if I had that, felt that way and that sober, I'd go ahead and drink. Who the hell are you? How do you know where they came from? They may have come from a place where you couldn't even stand up, and they're still here making coffee and welcoming you. I never want to forget that. About 6 months sober at that same time, I got the honesty part of the program. At about 6 months, you get honesty. At about 8 months, you get a little tact to go with it. I didn't know that at the time. I wish I would have waited. But I remember there was this priest, and he had thin blue lips. You know how they all are. And
He came up to me and said, Ed, why don't you come back to church?
And I said, I'll tell you why I don't go back. The church is full of thieves, hypocrites, and liars. And I felt pretty good about telling him, too. He looked back at me and said, well, why don't you come? One more won't hurt. I punished him. I didn't talk to him for 2-3 months, you know. And I knew it was just a matter of time before they brought up that three-letter word. And you know which one I'm talking about. It was going to come up sooner or later. And sure enough, I was sitting up there at Central Discussion one day, and it came up. Big John said, Ed, don't you think it's about time you got a job? Why? I'm still a pretty good thief. You know, isn't it funny in AA? I was sitting next to a guy the other night. He was telling me, he was bragging about having 11 felonies being a thief. And I said, well, obviously you're not a good one. You know? Isn't it really funny the way we think about things? But, but they said, no, you got to be honest. And not only cash register honesty, but you got to be emotionally honest. And man, that was all new territory for me. Because I had never been there. I already told you I would lie when the truth had served me better. I really had to work hard at telling the truth and not embellishing. Chuck C. used to always say, you know, and I took it to heart the minute he said it to me 33 years ago. He said, if you're ever given the honor to speak at these podiums and you start embellishing, it's just a matter of time before you drink. And I've taken that to heart. But, you know, at the start, I had to stop. Sometimes I'd be right in the middle of a sentence, and I'd have to say, oh, I'm sorry, that's a lie. Let me back up here. Sometimes it'd take me 2-3 tries. But I'd back up, and I'd start, and I'd, there you go, that's the truth, you know. They looked at me weird, but I didn't care. I was getting better, you know. Then they started talking about God, and it talks about in the book about being violently anti-religious, and I certainly was. I had a bag of ones about God. I remember when I was 10 years old, my cousin Linda, if there was anybody ever God-like, she was just wonderful. She just did everything right. She was beautiful. She straight A's and honor roll and this and that, and I just couldn't stand her. And, well, you know, because I was always comparing how I felt, how she looked, and she always looked so much better than me. And one day she was walking across the street, and a truck hit and killed her. And I'm in the funeral home, and I'm hearing people say, God must have wanted an angel. And I thought, so he hit you with a truck. I'll pass, yeah. You know what? I still do. I'll pass. But I had this image of a God that ripped people out of your life. They'd say things like, well, maybe there was something later in life they were saving him from. God took him. And I mean, no offense, please, but I need to share my faith before I got here. And I had a faith. I used to say I didn't have a faith. That's not true. I had a belief in God. I had a faith in God, and that's he was a punk, and I'd like to meet him and beat the sheet off him. And I wasn't trying to be funny. I was enraged. I was enraged. Imagine my surprise coming to A&A and they say, you know, the only way you're going to have long-term sobriety is develop a personal relationship with the God of your own understanding. I thought, boy, I'm in trouble. And then they give me one of the keys to the kingdom. They said, make up a God of your very own. So I said, you can do that? And they said, yeah, you can. I thought, cool. Thought about it for a few days, and I come up with a God. And I told them, I said, I've got a God. And they said, who's that, Ed? And I said, it's a God that's kind and loving and forgiving. They didn't seem to mind. But you see, that was 180 degrees from anything I'd ever believed about God. That was not in my ones at all. I told you the ones I had. And they said, well, that's who you pray to. When you pray, you bring that image to mind. So they gave me a God right away. And I'm here to tell you this morning, don't pray to something you're pretending to. There are certain times when acting as if is faith. There are certain times when it's lying, especially to yourself. And it's my opinion anyway, that I have to know where I'm at in my walk of faith. And if you're at a place where you don't know anything about what's going on, excellent. Start right there, you know? Because I made a major mistake. I started believing in God and I started praying to that. But then I started professing a faith I didn't have. I started saying things that were beyond my own experience, spiritually. You know, I look at stuff that I found a notebook a while back of stuff, poems and that I wrote when I was a year sober, and they were amazing poems. But I had no way the maturity to understand the meaning of those poems. I had the connection, but not the maturity. That's one of the tough things about getting young, sober a little younger. You don't have that maturity. But I urge you just to stay right where you're at. I started hearing old-timers in AA that would talk about God, and I'd look in their eyes, and they meant what they said. They were absolutely telling the truth, you know. So I started parroting what they said. Live and let live, day at a time. Have you prayed today? That's what you want to hear when you're 20 years sober from some six-month sober puke. Have you prayed today? Sure glad I'm my size. I would have been beaten badly a number of times, probably. And why is that important? I was about a year sober, a little over a year sober, in fact, and I was home. I had been working around the country and talking around the country on alcoholism and drug abuse, and because it was something for a 20-year-old to get sober at that time, and now it isn't a big deal at all, which is good. And my old man said, Ed, I want you to come. He said, boy, I want you to come over here for dinner tomorrow night. I thought, oh, God. Because, you know, when the old man calls me over for dinner, somebody's in trouble, and it usually isn't him, you know. But I'd hung around you, and you gave me some important information. You told me if I wanted my family life to change, it had to begin with me. I couldn't wait for them to change, that I had to change. And so I went there for dinner, and I got about halfway through dinner, and Dad said, boy, and I thought, oh, here it comes. I said, yeah, Pop. He said, just want to tell you I'm proud of you. Now, that may not mean much to you, but you know, if you're new and been around for a while, they talk about miracles in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need to tell you that I have experienced them, and I'm here to tell you that is exactly the truth, that miracles, and I know what the meaning of miracles is, and I've experienced them, but my old man telling me he was proud of me never even would have made my list of miracles. All the damage, all the hurt, all the pain I had caused. You know what I found out? The only thing my old man ever wanted was me to do good. It's all he ever wanted. And he told me he was proud of me, and that was one of the best nights of my life. I'll never forget that evening. Went to a meeting and went home afterwards, and I went to my sister-in-law's afterwards, and my mother called and was crying and hysterical, and Ed said, Ed, come home quick. And I said, what? Said, Dad went across the street to get himself a quart of beer and me a bottle of pop, and now there are police everywhere, and they're carrying bodies out. Please come home. And I jumped in the car, and I was driving home, and I was saying, well, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world, nothing can go wrong now. I got God in my life, and everything's good. And it was one of those ice storm nights. I'm sure you get them up here where you get a quarter-inch ice over everything. And so it was a bit tricky getting over there, and I'd pulled up in front of that bar where I drank since I was 11 years old, never carded. And there were more policemen there than I knew were in Davenport. They were just everywhere. Funny how those cops shaped up that year I was sober. Yeah. You know, I found out a few things that year I was sober. If I quit talking about their heritage, they'd usually quit talking about my heritage. I'd quit talking about their sexual habits, they'd quit talking about my sexual habits, you know. And I'd also worked in the court that year. I'd worked in the court, and they had seen me on a regular basis and knew that I was sober. And they respected that. And I walked in there and I often think how I just walked in there, but I did. I just walked into the bar, and there was an officer there, and he said, Ed, what are you doing here? And I said, my dad was in here. He said, oh, my God. And I said, why? What's wrong? He said, Ed, all we can tell you is somebody came in and opened fire and shot everybody. And I looked down the bar, and I saw a pool of blood with my father's glasses all smashed up and mangled in the pool of blood. And I knew, but I didn't want to know. Some of you know what I mean by that. Others don't, but that's okay. I knew, but I didn't want to know. It was too much information for me. And I did an amazing thing. I turned to my old arch enemy, an officer, and I said, what do I do? I don't know what to do. And he said, Ed, go up to the hospital. He said, some are still alive. Some are dead, but some are still alive. Go up there and see what you can find out. And I went up there to that hospital, and I ran into an officer who hadn't forgotten my past. And he was rude and vulgar. And nasty and basically told me to leave there immediately, or he'd have me run in for obstruction of an investigation or justice or something. And that he had identified all the bodies, my old man wasn't there. And he told me to get out of there, and another AA miracle happened. I said, okay. A year and a half before that, they would have been looking for a new lieutenant, because nobody talks to me in that manner. But just in the short year I'd been around you, you changed my heart and my mind. I didn't know it. I didn't know the depth, certainly. But you changed me already. I went home and I called the one guy I could have bet you couldn't have told me I would ever call. And that was the head of the narco division for the last 5 years of my drinking that tried to put me in jail. That's who I called. You know why? He was a good cop. He used to tell me what he was going to do. He said, one of these days I'm going to catch you, and I'm going to catch you clean and straight up, and you're going away for a long time. And he used to say to me, if I ever see you leaving the scene of a crime, or think I see you leaving the scene of a crime, I'm going to shoot to kill and not stop. And I'd say, everything's fair in love and war, chum. That's the guy I call, Bob. And I called Bob, and Bob said, Ed, what do you need? And I said, my dad was in the Shamrock. He said, oh, my God, hold on. And he fed me information as it came in. Now, you and I both know he shouldn't have done that. But he was a good man, is a good man. And he fed me information, said, Ed, all we can come up with is he was taken hostage or he wandered outside somewhere, got shot and wandered outside. So we formed a search party, and we searched for the next 10 hours, all night long, and we roamed those streets. And the only thing that would come to mind was the serenity prayer, one word at a time. And I couldn't handle two words at a time. One was sufficient. And early the next morning, that officer from the hospital called up and said, well, Ed, anybody could have made a mistake. Why don't you come up and identify your old man? And I said, okay. Got in the car and drove up there, and I drove into that hospital and walked into that morgue and saw my daddy laying there with that bullet hole in his face on the metal table. And I reached for that faith I'd been professing, and I came up with nothing. It was everybody else's jargon. And none of my spiritual work. And I don't know that I've ever felt more alone or more afraid or more angry or more fearful or more sad in my life than that moment. But you see, God does for me what I could not do for myself. I walked out of that morgue, and there stood members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And they just looked at me. And that's all they needed to do. And a couple of them gave me a thumbs up. And everywhere I went for the next few weeks, everywhere I went, there were members of Alcoholics Anonymous there. Thank you, God. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, because you walked me through the most difficult time of my life. A week later, I went to the funeral, and there was a guy there that did the funeral, gave me one of the keys to the kingdom. He said, you know, a lot of people say Clifford's death is God's will. And you heard about my bag of ones. And he said, I don't believe that. And I sat right up in the pew. He said, I believe God created human beings and gave them a free will. Some of those people chose to do this act, and now it's God's will. And the weight of the world fell off my shoulders. And from that day to this, I believe that if it isn't good, it isn't God, period. I don't have a God that's a psychologist that likes to play little jokes on me. Life tests me. But God doesn't tempt me, ever tempt me to do anything evil. You know, and I'm so glad that I know that. A lot of times I'll be sitting in a meeting and somebody will say, oh, God's testing me. And I just want to say, that's right, he stopped the whole world just to screw around with your day. You know? You're just that important. That's right. Yep. Forget the Mideast. What about Fred? You know? I got called to the murder trial to testify, and they made an impossible request. What an order. I can't go through with it. They said, Ed, when you go to court, you have to behave. I'd never done that before in my life. I'm not sure I knew the routine, you know. Because when I go to court, I'd start raising Cain that how many bailiffs took you into county was kind of your rep. And somebody got it. Yeah, I remember. And they said, you got to behave. So I went into court, and I remember sitting down, and I'm seeing this guy sitting there, and he had his little attitude and his do going. And I'm thinking, you know, you give me 5 minutes with him, we don't need a trial. In fact, bring all five of them in. Short business. But I didn't say any of that. What I did is what you asked me to do. I simply answered the questions the best way I could and remained respectful of the court and the people in there. Because at that time, they told me that you might be the only example of AA anybody ever sees. And that's so profound because we don't know. We don't know. You know, if you call yourself a good member of AA, what would your coworkers say? What would their opinion of AA be? What would the drivers on the highway think? You know? It's a good example. We're supposed to be doing this everywhere. And I always got to be mindful of that. I was talking to a guy I sponsored not too long ago. And we were talking about just that. I said, be aware of your actions no matter where you're at, your behavior. You're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you claim to believe in God. Act like it. And we're talking about this. And we had been talking. We'd sat in this restaurant. And we'd been talking for about 45 minutes. And the waitress came up and said, I am so sorry I forgot to put in your order. And immediately I said, it's so refreshing, that honesty. Thanks so much for telling us. Go ahead and put it in. She looked at me and said, are you okay, sir? And I said, yeah, no, we're having a good conversation, and that's fine. She said, no, sir, I'm really sorry. I said, no, I know that. No, I make mistakes, too. I said, you know, I'm just impressed by your honesty. I really do appreciate it. She sent the manager over to make sure I wasn't crazy, I guess. And the manager gave me free desserts. I'm not going to argue. Okay, yeah. And we continued our conversation, and about 15 minutes after that, they brought the meal and that, and we're eating. And it was in a place with those high booths where you can't see who's on the other side. And a couple got up and came around, and he came around to me and said, are you Ed M. in AA? And I said, yeah. He said, you know, I've got your CDs and your cassettes. And he said, you have changed my life, and I really thank you. And his wife had tears in her eyes and leaned over and kissed me on the cheek and said, thank you so much. It really touched my heart. And as they walked out the door, I thought about when that waitress came back. What if I would have said, you did what? What the hell? Because for a long time sober, that would have been my IQ. That would have been my IQ about the situation. It's important what we do. Everything we do is a reflection of everything you love. And I don't take that as a guilt trip. I take that as welcome information. You know. I testified at that murder trial, and the guy was found guilty, and the other guys were found guilty, and they got three life sentences and 135 years apiece, and I thought, good. And I went out to, God talked to me shortly after that. Now, you got to be careful when God talks to you. I'd suggest a sponsor in that case is what that's good for. Sponsors are excellent God filters. I went to my sponsor one time and I said, I got a message from God. He said, oh, really, Ed? And I said, yeah. He said, share it with me. And I shared it with him. He said, you know, Ed, this message from God looks strangely like your handwriting, you know. And indeed it was. But I also got to tell you, if you're reading 86, 87, 88 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it absolutely guarantees you to live a life of inspiration and no less on a more consistent level than inconsistent level. And that's been my experience as well, because a few years later when God talked to me and I talked to my sponsor about it, he agreed wholeheartedly, you know, and has pretty much ever since. So, but God talked to me and said, Ed, go out to California, get into show business. Made perfect sense to me. Now, I'd never been in show business, knew nothing about it, but God said it, so pack up. And I left Galesburg, Illinois at that time and ended up in Anaheim, California. I went to where all stars get their start, Disneyland. Yeah. I got a job as Goofy. Little did they know how well I fit the role at that point. 2.5 years sober, no sponsor. I was Goofy. Yeah. And I went up to a meeting by accident, or a God incident, if you will. In West L.A., and I saw a group of people who were enthusiastic, very much like the people who run this meeting, who were enthusiastic and full of Alcoholics Anonymous and full of love. And I was very attractive. It was very attractive because at that time I'm 23 years sober and not having a good time. And I go back up there the next week, and there's this guy hanging out there, and I said, excuse me, would you be my sponsor? He said, no. And I said, why not? He said, anybody I sponsor has to look up to me. Ha, ha, ha. And I thought, oh, good. Yeah, tall jokes, that'll help me. That'll be really good. A few minutes later, he came up to me and he said, if you agree to do what I tell you to do, I'll be your sponsor. My name's Clancy. And I'm forever grateful I didn't hear some of the crap that goes around about him, even if it's true. No, I'm not being smart, because if I would have heard it, you would have had another speaker this morning. Your gossip would have killed me. Because I believe Clancy was my Bill Wilson. He was the one that put it down to me saying, yeah, Ed, even you can find sanity and peace of mind, and yeah, even a God. He made it believable and showed me how to do it. So I try my best not to put down any group or individual in AA. Because I may not like them at all, but they may serve your purpose well. Who in the hell am I to tell you what's good or bad about AA? Think of the ego involved in that, you know. And you know, lately it's been quite apparent to me that when I first got sober, they used to talk about smashing of the ego. They don't talk about that much in meetings anymore. They talk about self-worth, which is building of the ego in so many ways. And I really need to remember that of myself, I am absolutely nothing. I am absolutely nothing. If I hadn't run into you, at best I would have been dead. At worst, lived a long time, you know. So I don't want to judge anybody else. I mean, if they ask me, if I'm their sponsor, and if they ask my advice, I give it. But you know what I try not to do anymore either? Is give unsolicited advice. I found out something really amazing. If somebody wants my opinion, they'll usually ask me for it. I don't feel I need to counsel them and correct them. You know, they have a sponsor to do that, and so do I, and I'm real grateful for that. But Clancy insisted that I could do things beyond my comprehension. And one of the things that he had me do was start all over on the steps and actually work them. Because I kind of like discussion meetings. Those are good. You know, first half of the meeting, I can think about what I'm going to say. Then it can get to me and I can be profound. And then I can think of how I could improve that the rest of the meeting. And Clancy said to me, you quit going to discussion meetings. And I said, why? And that's what he told me. He said, first part, you're going to be thinking about what you're going to say. You're going to participate and then think about, it's all going to be about you. He said, go to meetings and learn to listen. And you know, I did that for a long, long time, and just that. And I became a wonderful listener. I actually believe that what you have to say is more important than what I have to say. I won't cut you off mid-sentence anymore because I already got your answer. You know? It's really wonderful stuff. And one day I was going out to Pasadena, California. I was out there in L.A. and they asked me to speak in Pasadena. And I thought, ooh, wealthy area. Ooh, yeah, I'll get a job. I caught myself doing that little hustle and I went into my room and said the same prayer I said in my room this morning. I had started all over with God after my father was murdered. My first honest prayer was, God, I don't know if you're there or not. I sure hope so. That was the truth. Shake it all out. That was the truth. And I got down on my knees and I said, God, let me go there and save me from my own nonsense. Let me share the miracle you've performed in my life through Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want absolutely nothing from these people. And I went and I talked at that meeting, and when I was done with the meeting, a guy came up to me and said, this makes no sense to me, but I want to offer you a job. I said, makes perfect sense to me. You know. He said, have you ever been in Taiwan? I said, no. He said, have you ever been in show business management? I said, no. He said, be in my office Monday morning. I followed direction. I showed up at his office Monday morning. Thursday, I was lifting out of Los Angeles International Airport, going to Taipei, Taiwan. I was new, soon-to-be vice president of America on Ice. I had a cast of 62 skaters. I was flying over to Taipei to negotiate with the Taiwanese government the building of the ice rink, the stage, the curtains, etc., while flying back and forth with designer Bill Campbell to Hong Kong to design the costumes. How was your week? You know why I share that with you? You talked me into dropping my bag of ones. There would have been a time when I wouldn't even gone to the interview. Oh, people like me don't do things like this. White trash. Worthless. No value. Oh, that job, oh, I wish I could do that, but not me. I showed up. And I loved it. Next thing you know, like I said, I was on a plane. I got off in Taipei, Taiwan. Everybody's this tall. And they're looking at me, and I'm looking at them, you know. I knew it was just a matter of time before they tied me down. Uh-huh. And I don't have time to go into it, but I had a wonderful time there. What I found out there is I had gifts and talents that I would have never believed I had unless I'd been in the position to see that I did it. There was nobody else there to do it. I had to have done it. Because you see, that's how much I was unwilling to believe that there was some goodness in me. My old friend Chuck C. Taught me how to pray. I said, "Chuck, how do you pray?" And he said, "Eddie, your every thought's a prayer." And I went, "Uh-oh." I'd done a little edit of what I'd been thinking that day. But you know what I realized? Well, if I'm thinking crap, why don't I replace it with something that God would like? It's called praying unceasingly. So if you're worried about prayer and you don't know how to do that, you might try that. Just making your every thought a prayer. And you're never going to be perfect, but you can get better and better and better. And the more you get better, the more peace flows in. At least that's been my experience. And while we were in Taiwan, a guy walked by me and said, "You know, you'd be an excellent manager for the Harlem Globetrotters." Yeah, sure. Seventh grade education, you know. Tell any records as long as, "Yeah, I'm going to be manager of the Harlem Globetrotters." That's what I did. Got home 3 months later, the Harlem Globetrotters called me up. Said, "Mr. Mutum, we've heard wonderful things about you. Would you come in and interview?" I was no longer in possession of my bag of ones, so I suited up and showed up. Because I'll tell you something I found out in sobriety. It's easier to stay in a rut than get better. It's easier to stay in what's familiar than to go out there and do the best you can. Go out there and say yes to opportunities. It's just easier. And I think a lot of times I know I use that as an excuse. The other thing I used as an excuse is, "I'm only human." I hate that. Somebody said it here. The highest you get is human. Not to my understanding. Human is the lowest you get. Human means you're another raccoon around gathering nuts, you know? Just another animal on this planet. Spirituality and the 12 steps are to help me above my humanness, not to wallow in it, but to lift me above it. I have no interest in being human. I have tremendous interest in finding God and being with Him. And I can do that right now. I can do that right now. I went in and interviewed in a short 8-hour interview because I told them the truth. I've never held anything back about my past everywhere I go. My life is an open book. You want to talk about the time I was gang raped in Job Corps? Sure, let's talk about it. You want to talk about the time I hit my wife when I was drinking? Let's talk about it. You want to talk about the time that my brother was killed after 3 years sober, went out drinking, we buried him at 36? Let's talk about it. You have given me the right to be present, and I love that. You have given me the right to live in the present moment of now. A while back, I was sitting in the office, and a guy came in to talk to me, and he said, "Ed, it was on a Monday," and he said, "You know, I'm really going to be depressed Friday." And I thought, well, at least he's planning them. That's good. We got, at least we got some thought going into it, you know. And I said, "Why?" And he said, and he got real sad, and he said, "It's the anniversary of my daughter's death." And I said, "Oh." So I was prayerful for a little while. And I said to him, "Why don't you do this? Friday morning when you, or Thursday night before you go to bed, get your favorite picture of your daughter and put it right beside your bed. Friday morning when you wake up and you open your eyes, the minute you open your eyes, you start celebrating her life. And every curl and every butterfly kiss and every tickle and every giggle. And all day long, you just lift her memory and thank God she was with you for that while. Or you can make it all about you." He made a request that was physically impossible and slammed the door as he went out. And I totally understood that because I spent years in meetings being a professional mourner. I loved when something bad came up so I could share it in meetings. When my father was murdered, there was some sort of payoff when I walked into the room and somebody'd go, "You know, his father was murdered in that chamber." Say that out loud makes me sick, but it makes it no less true. I'm supposed to be living in the present moment of now. And I don't want to take anybody's death as an excuse for me. And if I had a legitimate reason to be sad, I'd run it into the ground. But there's so many reasons to be happy. You know, I met a lot of wonderful people this weekend. Two of the nicest people I met is Josh and Spider. Now, how would I meet them? Their spirit's here. I see it in your eyes. I see it in your heart. I see it in your mind. I am so pleased I got to meet them. And I will celebrate their life daily in prayer, because that's the way I want to live today. I want to celebrate the goodness rather than dwell in the sadness and not make it all about me. Yeah, there's a time for normal grief and natural grief. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying there's a time also to remember that sometimes our taking those emotions takes away from their memory and takes away from their spirit. If you're going to believe in spirit and you're going to believe in energy, you got to believe that if we're worrying about them and sad about them, it pulls their spirit. There's a story that I just love about healing in that area, and it's a guy who, and I watched it happen. A guy who had lost his son 4 years before, and his heart was broken. He could not get through a day without sobbing deeply. He just couldn't. And he went to see this person. He said, I don't know what to do. I can't go to work. I go to work, I sob. And he said, well, he said, what faith are you? And he said, Christian. He said, okay. Can I do some guided imagery with you? And will you do some work with me? And he said, yeah. And he said, okay, I want you to envision the gates of St. Peter, however you see them. And if they're big and beautiful, that's wonderful. If they're golden gates, that's wonderful. Just see them. And then I want you to see outside at the golden gate, St. Peter there with a candle and a line in front of him that goes on forever. And people would walk up to St. Peter and light their candle off their candle. And as they lit their candle, their face would glow and they'd be at peace and they'd walk into those pearly gates. He said, can you see that? And he said, yeah, I can see that. He said, okay, I want you to look over to the left at a bench on the side. And I want you to see your son sitting there with an unlit candle. And I want you to ask him a question. And if it's okay with you, I'll answer for him. Is that okay with you? He said. And the man said, yes, that's okay. He said, I want you to ask your son why you're sitting there. And he said, son, why are you sitting there? And the man said back to him, Daddy, every time I light my candle, your tears drowned it out. Let's make it about lifting people up and letting them go. Yeah, there's sadness, but there is so much more goodness. And I'm just delighted that I've met Josh and Spider this weekend, two of the nicest people I've known, and I've been around a while. Now, how do I know that? I look into the eyes of those who loved them, and you're just a reflection of their love and their spirit and their grace. Went up for that interview at the Harlem Globetrotters, and like I said, 8 hours interview. They gave me the job. Now, I don't know about you, but in my house there was only one time a year when anything was happy, it seemed. And that was in mid-January. They'd be on Wide World Sports, and they'd be popping popcorn, and Dad would be sober, and everybody would be happy. We'd be sitting around. You know why? Because there was going to be this basketball team come on TV. And there'd be a great song, Sweet Georgia Brown. They'd start whistling that song and that warm-up circle. And my dad would smile, and my mom would smile, and my brothers, sisters would smile, and there would be peace and happiness in my house. Imagine how I felt in Madison Square Garden, giving the sign to Meadowlark Lemon to start the game in that warm-up circle. When they talk about miracles, they mean it. Not just for me. If that's not a miracle, if that's not an act of God, tell me how I got from 6th and LeClaire laying in the middle of the street 8 years later, Madison Square Gardens, and the manager of the Harlem Globetrotters, doing a job that I was no more qualified for, I thought, than the man on the moon. But you know who knows my qualifications better? God. So I need to say yes to opportunities instead of run away because it's inconvenient. Or run away because I may have to change something I want to hang on to. I need to be able to be reachable and teachable. Boy, time flies when you're having fun. I want to tell you this, then I'll sit down. I went back to Iowa in 1988. I made some decisions based on self that cost me everything I own materially. I had done very well and then just lost everything in a matter of 3 to 6 months. Everything was gone. I was evicted. They repossessed the car. And for the first time in my sober life, I couldn't get anything going. I could always get a job. I could always get something going. Couldn't this time. And I moved back to Iowa because that was home. And I thought, well, if I'm going to start all over, I might as well start home. And I came back to Iowa, and I've always remained active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God for that. And I opened the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in this house that was abandoned, and they turned their head and allowed me to ply the wood off the windows. And I had a mattress with a bulb. It sounds like some bad movie. And I had the big book, and I started reading the promises, and I said, where did I go wrong? Because the promises aren't. If I'm not experiencing the promises, if I'm not experiencing everything, it's something I'm not doing. Because that's the truth, in my opinion. And I started fresh. One day God said to me, Ed, go to school. You need an education. And I did what any good alcoholic would do. I went, la, 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 la. But I've learned that you don't argue, so I grabbed my crutches. I had broken my leg. I quit smoking, and they told me to start running. If you're 300 pounds, don't run. You break your leg, by the way. So I hobble over there to the university, and I go into the university. I said, I'd like to go to school. And they said, how many credits do you have? And I said, I got bad credits. Why? What's that got to do with it? And they laughed like you laughed, and I said, no, you don't seem to understand. I don't know anything about going to school. I got kicked out in seventh grade, and I wasn't paying attention then. I'm not sure if I'm smart enough to pass a class, but I can tell you this. I'll sure try my best if you'll let me. Never in my sobriety, when I've sincerely asked for help, have I been told no, ever, from any source. And before you knew it, I was in university going to school. I had taken a GED as a joke out in California. I was dating this gal who went to Vassar, and she was annoyed I didn't have a high school education. One Saturday, I saw that they were passing them out at UCLA for GED, so I went over there and took the test and said, here you go, sweetie, my high school education. And that's what got me into college. And I started going to college, and it was wonderful. Went on a Christian retreat given to me by a guy's father that I sponsored. And on that retreat, I had a spiritual awakening that has changed my life from that day to this. I have not been the same person. Anybody who's known me before and known me after would tell you that. I hear a lot of people keep wanting to pull me back to where I used to be. And that's okay. I don't need to go. I know in my heart and my mind who I am today and who I hope to be. And that's all I want to do. And my only goal today is to be close as God is my own breath. That's what I want to be today. I don't want anything else other than that. And I don't really care what you think about that because it's between me and God, you know. And I've never left Alcoholics Anonymous. I find a lot of people call me up and said, you know, I found Jesus, Ed, and I don't go to meetings anymore. And my sponsor told me to call you, and I said, and talk to you. And I said, good, what meeting would you like to meet at, you know? I am all for Jesus. Jesus is my personal Savior. By the way, you're allowed to say that if that's your higher power. If they say you aren't, tell them to work on their defects and leave you alone. I have found that my activity in Alcoholics Anonymous keeps Christianity functioning quite well a day at a time in my life. Because the 12 steps are rock-bed first century Christianity anyway. And applying that, there is no hindrance and no one-sidedness about that. And I can come here and I can have my God and you can have your God. And I celebrate all of them. I'm not one of those that say, you got to believe the way I believe. I believe you got to believe the way you can really believe. And I support you 100%, you know. And I stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to seminary. Took me 7 years. I had to get 230 hours of college credit to get my little Master's of Divinity and BA, and I did that. And was ordained and got my master's degree and all that stuff. And that impresses a lot of people. The only reason I did it is they said that was required, so I did that. And I'm pleased I did. I'm going on to get my doctorate now in psychology so I can argue with the doctors on their level rather than saying, well, are you a doctor? Yeah, here. You know? So, 2 years. 2 years. You think you know so much about addiction? Yeah. We'll see. About 4 years ago, I was preaching on forgiveness in a big church. I had been appointed. I had a 1,200-member church, and it was a wonderful church. And right in the middle of the sermon, I stopped preaching. I said, I'm sorry. I can't preach on forgiveness here. I haven't done it. I haven't found the guys who killed my father and told them that I forgive them. And I will not preach on forgiveness again till I do that. And I changed the sermon, talked about something else. As God would have it, 2.5 weeks later, one of those guys' sentences was overturned after 27.5 years. They found a glitch in the trial record, and they overturned the case, and they said, retry him or let him go right now. And the press came to me. I'm well known and loved in my community by the way you have taught me to behave and to believe. And the press all came and said, Pastor Ed, what do you think? What do you think? And I said, well, it's time to heal. It's time to let him come home. Let him start fresh. And one of the reporters said, well, Ed, you know, he went in there when he was 17 years old, and he doesn't know where's he going to live, where's he going to work. He didn't learn a trade. And I said, he can come live with me if he'd like. And people were taken back by that, but I'm not sure why. You let me come in here. Given the right situation and the right amount of alcohol, or the wrong amount of alcohol and the wrong situation, I would be where my brother is. How dare I not offer him everything you've offered me? 2.5 weeks later, I found myself walking down that hall of that prison I swore I'd never go back into, where my brother spent so much time, walking into a cell and seeing a guy I hadn't seen in 27.5 years. The last time I saw him, I said, you give me 5 minutes, we won't need a trial. This time I saw myself reaching out my hand and saying, Sherman, my name's Reverend Ed Mutum, and I'm here to tell you that God loves you and I love you. And he forgives you and I forgive you. And I have one request for you. And he said, what's that? And I said, if there's anything I can ever do in my life to make your life better, allow me to do that. And a healing took place like I'd never known. Oddest thing was, we became friends. Hadn't planned on that. And we started talking. And they decided to retry him. You know, in the state of Iowa, if you're with somebody in the commission of a felony, you're just gone, especially first-degree murder, for life. And I went down and I talked to the county attorney, and I asked him for mercy for my friend. He said, Ed, the guy's just conning you. I said, he can't be conning me. You don't even know I'm here. I'm here because I want a new life for my friend like I've been given. And he listened. And a year and a half later, they called me up and said, Reverend Mutum, Sherman will be released Monday morning, and we'll release him only to you. Now, you know that's impossible. The son of one of the murder victims in the state of Iowa will only release him to them. That's the credibility. That's the man you've made of me today. Because of myself, I'm nothing. I'm laying in the middle of the street, not knowing what to do. I went up and picked Sherman up and brought him home. He stayed home for a while and couldn't take it. You know, when you've done 30 years or 27 years of maximum security, it's a little tough to adjust, especially when you go in there at 17 years old. The horror he's been through, I still pray for him every day for a healing. And his attitude sent him back, and a year later he called me up and said, I know, Reverend Mutum, I goofed up and I came back from that work camp and that, but do you know any place I could stay? And I said, yeah, you can stay with me, Sherman. That was our deal. And I went up and I picked him up and I got him an apartment where I live, and got him some job, got him some nice clothes to make him feel presentable instead of that prison issue crap, and let him know that I believed in him. Now, how is that possible? Because January 5th in 1971, I walked through these doors. A guy named Hap said, you can do this, Ed. All you got to do is try. And then I ran into a sponsor I've had for 32 years. That I will be always indebted to, and especially his wife, who invited me to church one day, and I said, oh, I don't think I should go. She said, no, Ed, I think God would like it if you came. And I went, and he did. If you're having troubles, if you're having a tough time, leave it here. Start fresh, start new. One thing about these steps, they don't care when you start over. I mean, talk to your sponsor about it. But if you're having a tough time, start fresh and new. What do you got to lose besides misery and fear and apprehension and yesterday? And you know, it isn't old behavior if you're still doing it. It's called current behavior, you know? And you know what? You can put that down too, and you can stop anytime you want. The last thing I learned that was most difficult for me was I had to start treating myself as if I actually liked me. It's not a matter of self-esteem. It's a matter of God esteem. If I believe you're a child of God, then I have to believe I am too. So when I'm wondering how to treat myself, I'll ask myself, how would I treat Larry? How would I treat Jack if he was in the same jam? And I'll tell you how I do it. I do it out of love and respect and compassion and do anything I could do to give them comfort. Why? Because I'm a child of God and I've got the right to be here. Where did I learn that? Not in seminary. I learned that in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and the healings that take place like have taken place this weekend. God bless you and thank you for having me.